Good morning, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. Now, for the past 2 weeks, our topic has been social justice. And social justice has become a buzzword in our culture today. In fact, mainline liberal Christianity is now in lockstep with secular society in elevating this concept of social justice as a supreme moral objective. And in the church and in the culture, one often hears the words of the Old Testament prophet Micah said these words. He said, "What does the Lord require of you?" And the answer, to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. But as we have seen in the last two programs, there's a big difference between what the Bible means by social justice or justice and the culture. And certainly, there's a big difference in the biblical understanding of the role of government and how the government has usurped power to become this nanny state. Now, today, we're very, very fortunate to have with us a special guest who's coming to us all the way from Virginia Beach by way of Skype. He is Dr. Max Lyons. And Rita, in particular, has been quoting from his book for the last 2 weeks. And so, Rita, why don't you just tell us a bit about how you met Dr. Lyons and how you discovered this book?
I'd be happy to. The book that I've mentioned for the past 2 weeks is called Government Takes All, What's Left for Me. One day last year, I was in the Virginia Beach area to give an educational presentation about the Convention of States Project. And as you know from past programs, the motivating force behind the Convention of States Project is this conviction that our federal government today is operating far beyond the bounds of its constitutional authority. So we are trying to get the states to use their power under Article 5 of the Constitution to propose amendments that will put the feds back in their rightful, limited place. Well, just before that meeting in Virginia Beach was about to start, one of our volunteers came up to me and introduced me to Dr. Max Lyons. And Dr. Lyons just graciously handed me this book. And he wrote a nice message inside the cover that said, "Thanks for your hard work for liberty." So I thanked him, of course, for the book. Then I went on to concentrating on my presentation. And when I got back home, I sort of forgot about it for a while and then rediscovered it later. And once I actually opened it up and started reading, I was just amazed at how clearly and concisely Dr. Lyons presented the biblical view of government. So I'm excited to share Dr. Lyons with you all today.
A great read. In fact, I think you were so impressed by this book that you based a Sunday school class at your church around this theme. So, yeah. Dr. Lyons, we're again excited to have you by way of telephone and technology, and we hope and pray that the technology holds up throughout our program. But why not tell us a bit about yourself, Dr. Lyons, and give us something of your background so our audience can get to know you.
Okay, Doug. Well, first of all, I thank you, Doc and Rita, for having me on, and thank you both for your work for liberty. And I know producing shows like this and teachings is a lot of work, and just thank you. I'm glad to be a part of this work. And just a little bit about myself. I'm currently the Director of Teaching Services for the Foundation for American Christian Education, known by the acronym FACE, and we're at FACE.net. If you want to, a lot of people sit in front of their computer, you want to Google it and get there and see what FACE is all about. Been here for about a year. Part of that, I was 35 years in Christian schools as a teacher and administrator and a curriculum writer, teacher trainer, and so forth. Have 4 children and a wonderful wife and 7 grandchildren.
Wow.
Well, it sounds like you're a pretty busy guy, and that's great, but it leads me to ask, what actually prompted you to write this book? I'm sure it took a lot of time, and why did you decide to write a book on this subject?
Well, I've been teaching history and government economics, kind of the humanities biblically, for 3 decades. But I saw a real need because I have this phrase that I use, your liberty is my passion. Mm. And your liberty is also, the reason it's my passion is because it's God's passion. He wants us to be free in every area of our life. And I just see in this generation, I see our liberties being eroded. And this is just my small contribution to help bring an understanding that will point us back to liberty. And the whole idea of limited government is biblical. And it really concerned me that I hear, I listen to a lot of talk radio and I hear the, conservatives talk about limited government over and over and over again. Outside of the biblical context, and it really provoked me that I wanted people to understand that this limited government and this liberty that we're supposed to have that I talk about in this book, that it's a biblical idea. I just read Job 14:4, and it says basically that man has limits and that he cannot exceed. So just one place in Scripture, kind of an unexpected place, that you saw the idea of limits, mm-hmm. of jurisdiction.
Dr. Lyons, before we go on, maybe this would be a good time for you to just tell folks how they can log on to your. Do you have a website, or how they can get your books?
Well, my books, including Government Takes All, are available through the Foundation for American Christian Education. So I would just have people go there. We published about 150 items, mostly on the subjects of Christian education, government. We publish primary sources primarily, and we publish the original Noah Webster's 1828 dictionary, which is a wonderfully biblically based dictionary. So there's a lot of material there for just about anyone, homeschoolers, Christian mm-hmm. teachers, as well as patriots who just are interested in.
So is it the acronym FACE.org or how?
FACE.net, yes.
FACE.net. Okay. Well, let's get into the book. The first chapter, Dr. Lyons, discusses the concept of decentralized authority. So tell us why it's so important that government authority be decentralized in our human society.
Well, I think at its root, this idea of decentralization, as you think about God versus man, God is perfect. So in terms of him, he's the sovereign, all power, was given, all power in heaven and earth was given unto Jesus. So God is all powerful. Power is not decentralized there. But man, power needs to be decentralized. And the debate's basic difference is, perfect versus sin nature. God is perfect, so we don't ever have to worry about abuse of power with God. And yet with man, we always have to worry about abuse of power. So that's the first thing to understand. The second thing is the history of the world is the history of centralization of authority, and whether it's kings, czars, monarchs, you go down through the whole history of the world, and power was centralized, except in a few small civilizations, notably Israel, and then starting in Europe after the Reformation, starting to move in that direction of decentralized authority up until the establishment of our nation. So our American founders, they knew history, and they were passionate about this idea. If you read their writings, especially the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers.
Yeah.
So the Scriptures, as well as the founders of America, they were passionate about multiple authorities, and they felt like most power and authority should be with the individual and mm-hmm. and the family, and that civil government should be very decentralized to the extent that, power is divided. Power is not only divided among multiple authorities, the individuals, families, churches, and voluntary associations, but our civil government, we have local, state, and national. And at the national level, it's divided even further, you know, with the three branches of government.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, you know, biblically comes from Isaiah 33:22. You know, God is our judge, he is our lawgiver, and he's our king. This concept is all through the Bible and all through history as well. And we got to realize that the bottom line is power is centralized in government, liberty decreases. Every time government, civil government, gets more power, that means we got less.
Yes.
The individual, the families, and the churches, we got less. So it's a critical idea.
Yeah. Well, getting a little bit more specific with that idea, over the past 2 weeks on this program, we've described for our listeners that basic framework that you set forth in your book as being God's design for society. God has authority over all, but beneath him, he has delegated particular functions to the individual, the family, the church, voluntary associations, and civil government. But in the book, you really emphasize that Christian self-government is the foundation for a properly functioning society. Can you explain that for us a bit?
Just a little fun thing aside here. I drive a red Volvo, and on my license plate is self-gov. So I am a little bit passionate about that topic. And by the way, that helps me in my driving to really kind of keep myself under control there.
Good for you.
But if you read the writing of the founders, it's hard to escape that this was a central idea for them. And why was that? It's because it's a biblical idea, and they were students of the Bible. So let's define Christian self-government. First of all, you notice the word Christian in there. We're not talking about just individualism or self-autonomy or just, you know, this radical idea of just a person doing whatever they want. It's we're talking about Christian self-government. So basically, what does that mean? It's basically you are controlling or we're governing ourselves under God's government. That's how I define it.
Mm-hmm.
The longer version of Christian self-government is governing or controlling myself under God's government. In other words, according to the precepts of the Bible. And this is not a new idea, but it's one that, again, that we've moved rapidly away from. You know, it's internal control versus external control. There's a wonderful quote you probably heard by Robert Winthrop, which says that all societies of men must be governed in some way or another. Men must be controlled either by a power within them or a power without them, either by the word of God or by the strong arm of man, either by the Bible or the bayonet. Mm-hmm. And it's true. It's a very succinct way of elucidating the idea of Christian self-government.
So, Doctor, is there a correlation between how well individuals perform, you know, their role of self-government and whether the rest of society can function as it should?
Well, you think about it, you know, if individuals are self-governed, individuals make up families. So then we would have a self-governed family. Families make up churches, you know. A church is a family of families. So if you had self-governing individuals and families, you'd have a self-governed church. Also, businesses and volunteer associations, they're made up of individuals. So, you know, on the civil level, representatives reflect the constituents. You know, it's been said that we get the kind of government that we resemble. And it's true. I mean, the foundation of society at all levels and all jurisdictions is individuals. So,
yes.
If we're governing ourselves, that's the basis for good government at all levels.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that this carries, I'd say, profound implications for both the family and the church, since both of these institutions have a significant role to play in teaching and nurturing individuals. Would you comment on that?
Oh, I absolutely agree. You know, parents have the incredible responsibility, as in Ephesians 6:4, it says, to bring our children up in the nurture which in the Greek is means chastening, discipling them, and the admonition, which in the Greek is teaching. So the bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Well, why would we chasten them? Because I have 4 children and 7 grandchildren, and I know that you start right away. You chasten them because you're trying to get them to develop this Christian self-government, this internal control, so that they won't need the external authority, whether it's parent, teacher, or policeman or civil ruler in the future. So we have a tremendous responsibility to train them in Christian self-government and Christian character, and the church does too. We're discipling people. What does that mean? We're helping them become models of Christ.
And Dr. Lyons, aren't grandchildren great? You can discipline them and then send them home to their parents. We probably should have started with grandchildren, I think.
Well,
absolutely.
I, of course, being as young as I am, don't know anything about that yet. But I wanted to add that I thought for anyone who has been watching the news in the past week, we really got an interesting visual picture.
Absolutely.
Of this idea with the situation in Baltimore and the mother who interposed herself between her son, who I assume was engaged in some thug-like activity,
yes,
and the civil government. And she decided that she was going to be the one to get involved and correct him. So we might question her methods a little bit, but...
Well, she used some pretty rough language. She slapped him up the side of the head, but I call that tough love. And I would love to see our president lift up this woman as a positive example.
Well, just to be an engaged parent,
yes,
who is concerned and active and knows what her kids are up to, I thought that was interesting. Well, I'd like to move in now, Dr. Lyons, and have you discuss the part of the book that I found most intriguing. And that is the part where you describe various institutions in our world as having been given either a negative role to play in society or a positive role. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure thing. Well, basically there are 5 jurisdictions, or you could call them authority or power centers. Yeah, the individual, the family, the church, volunteer associations, and that would be like Salvation Army and Red Cross and so forth. We have over 1 million nonprofit volunteer associations in America.
Wow.
And then civil government. Now, the interesting part about this is 4 of these jurisdictions are supposed, they have responsibilities. They have good things that they're supposed to do. Teach, train, disciple, provide for, educate, provide health care, on and on it goes. Provide goods and services in the case of businesses. They all have good things that they're supposed to be doing. And they have a limited ability to punish wrongdoing. You think of parents, they can discipline their children, they can spank them biblically. Family can discipline its own family members in the business, in the church. You have church discipline. You could even to the point of excommunicating someone. So they have all of these jurisdictions have a limited authority to punish wrongdoing, but their primary responsibility is the doing of all the good that needs to be done in this world. Civil government, however, is different. Its primary role is not as a doer of good, but as it says in Romans 13, very clearly, it's to be a punisher of evil.
Mm-hmm.
So if it punishes evil, this means it's protecting the life, liberty, and property of its citizens. If it's fulfilling that role, then what happens? The other 4 jurisdictions can do a maximum of good. When evil is held down in society and when justice is being provided against evildoers, the military is functioning well and the police and the courts and so forth, then that will mean the other 4 jurisdictions can maximize the good that they do.
Yeah.
However, the problem is when the punisher of evildoers decides to become a doer of good. And then one scripture that points this out is in Luke 22:5, where Jesus talks about, he says, the kings of the Gentiles exercise authority and they call themselves benefactors.
Uh-huh.
And I came across that. I looked it up in the Greek. What is a benefactor? A benefactor is a worker of good, mm-hmm. or a philanthropist.
Mm-hmm.
God did not ordain, you know, civil authorities to be workers of good, but rather to restrain evildoers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's so interesting, Doctor. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
I was just going to go back to Baltimore and talk about how tragic that the mayor told the police to stand down and not exercise their authority in restraining, you know, the evil that was taking place. It's a perfect example of misplaced authority there. Well, so what are the dangers, Dr. Lyons, or what's the downside for society if government then crosses over into having a more proactive, or I would say aggressive, role? And can you give us an example of that?
Sure. Well, the examples abound. We're experiencing those dangers just every day. It's frightening. But what happens is, here's where I think that the danger comes in. In order to become a doer of good, they have to have two things. They have to have power, and they have to have money.
Mm-hmm.
And government has two powers that the other four jurisdictions don't have. They have the power to tax, to take away our property, and they also have the power of the sword. You know, their ability to punish people that have broken the law is a lot greater than any of the other jurisdictions. So because of these advantages, they can take power and money to them from the other jurisdictions to be able to become a doer of good. And that's what we've seen in our nation increasingly more, but really going back a long time in our history. We've been moving away from the biblical ideal toward the government becoming this, quote, doer of good. But when this power, more and more power and authority come to the government to, quote, do good, this is the very definition of tyranny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what do we have today? We have the government, you know, the examples abound. We have government providing education, welfare, health care, housing, food, on and on. And so what happens? Power and authority is taken away from the other, you know, families and churches and individuals for government to be able to do those things. But along with that becomes control and the possibility of abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me that there are a lot of Americans today whose fundamental belief is that if something is good, then the government should be doing it. In fact, I think that may be the major problem and the major reason why our country is in such a crisis right now. A lot of Americans view government as this institutional Santa Claus, whose job is to make society good and to hand out good things to people who need them. So we've already discussed the fact that doing good and taking care of people is not the proper function of a government. But I found it really interesting how your book introduces the concept of plunder to describe what it is that is happening when the government tries to be Santa Claus. Can you explain that whole idea of plunder and why you think that is the appropriate description?
Well, I got this idea from the French philosopher Friedrich Bastiat. And if you have never read any of Bastiat, go and get, there's a wonderful little book called The Law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was just recently introduced to that, Doctor.
But I say get it and read it and buy copies of it and give it out to people, because he really nails it. And what he says in there, I'll just kind of summarize this idea of plunder. He says that law or government is the collective organization of the individual right to lawful defense, to defend your person, liberty, and property. He defines law and government biblically. And then he says plunder is when you take from one person and give to the next. And he divides it He says there's illegal plunder and there's legal plunder. Illegal plunder is like, you know, you take something from your neighbor, you steal it. That's illegal. But legal plunder is when you get you use the power of the government to take from your neighbor. You know, you probably all have seen the bumper sticker that says, do not steal, let the government do it for you. You know, we laugh at that, but it's not funny.
Yeah.
Bastiat said, and I quote Bastiat, it is impossible to introduce into society a greater change and a greater evil than this, the conversion of the law into an instrument of plunder.
Wow.
That's a fascinating concept, and a friend just recently introduced me to Bastiat, and I intend to continue reading it. One of the hot button issues, Doctor, that all of this brings up is the area which you've already alluded to, that is of education. How does education fit into all this? You're an educator, spent your life in education. Is it the role of government to educate our children, or should parents, you know, properly delegate that role to the state?
Well, first of all, I would challenge everybody in this. Can you point to any portion of Scripture, you know, Genesis to Revelation, that says that it's responsibility of civil government to educate children? No, you cannot. You cannot, and you can't even try to, because it's not there. It is a responsibility of parents. And churches also have a secondary responsibility in education of children. In this nation, we recognize that, and for the first 200 years, read the history of education of our nation, we had 200 years of private, mostly Christian education. And we produced the greatest level. There was almost 100% literacy, and we produced a generation like the founding fathers that wrote things that created things that we can hardly read and understand because of the level of literacy. Consequently, can you find a place in the Constitution in those powers given to the government for education? Of course not. It's not in there. So, yeah, the answer to your question is no. We need to return education to the private sector.
All right, this is a note just to us here and to line. We have about 3 minutes left, and we need to tighten up our questions and answers just a bit. Rita?
Sure thing.
Yeah, I think we might have to have you back for a separate program
yes.
at some point on education. But the other big issue here, of course, is the issue of charity and the
yeah.
impact of this biblical model of government on social welfare programs. Your
yeah.
book describes a biblical model of charity. Can you describe that for our audience?
Well, first of all, to get the longer description, I highly recommend Marvin Olasky's book, The Tragedy of American Compassion.
Mm-hmm.
He details how this biblical model was actually worked out in our nation for a couple of hundred years before we got the welfare state. And that is a fascinating read. So the second thing, place I would take you to for the biblical model is 1 Timothy 5. Which says, in essence, the safety net for those that are not able to take care of themselves. Those that should work should get a job.
Yes.
2 Thessalonians 3:10 is very clear about that. But those that are either the working poor or those that need cannot work because of disability or age or whatever. The safety net, biblically, according to 1 Timothy 5:8, is the family.
Well, Dr. Lyons, it's been wonderful to share these 30 minutes with you. We're grateful to the Lord that the technology has held up. We want to thank our listeners today for tuning in to Crossroads and encourage you to continue being salt and light in the world to make a difference for Jesus at the crossroads where faith and culture meet. We encourage you to support our program by sending your contributions to Crossroads Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia, 22803. And if you want Dr. Lyons' book, go to face.net. God bless you.